Tonight's lecture concerns itself with Mar Bar Ravashi, Mar the son of Ravashi, who is already at the end of the period of the Talmud, the last generation of the period of the Talmud. He lives already into the 6th century of the Common Era, and he's a very noted figure, so much so that in the Jewish world, for millennia almost, if you wanted to say that someone is a great scholar, you said he's Mar Bar Ravashi. And if you wanted to say that he's not a great scholar, then you said he's not Mar Bar Ravashi. But Mar Bar Ravashi became the symbol of Torah scholarship, of Jewish scholarship generally. And so it's interesting to know why he was chosen. Why didn't we say, for instance, he's not Rabbi Akiva, or he's not Rabbi Yudah Anossi, or why didn't he say he's not Ravashi, his father? Why do we say he's not Mar Bar Ravashi? So there's an interesting background to this, which really tells the story of this great man. And it also indicates to us the purity of motives, the holiness of Chazal, how they viewed matters, and how independent they were from ordinary human considerations, so to speak, how they rose above ordinary human considerations in dealing with their institutions and communities and dealing with their colleagues as well. There's a difference of opinion whether his name is Mar Bar Ravashi, whether that's his name, or whether that's a title. And his real name was Avyumi, the son of Ravashi. From many sources, it appears that his real name was Avyumi, and Mar was a title. We find that by the great scholar Shmuel in the first century of the Amoraim. So he was called Mar Shmuel. And Mar oftentimes signified that the person never received ordination. He never received smicha. And therefore, in order to indicate that he was not Rav or Rabbi, they said Mar. So even though you could be like Shmuel, the greatest Talmud Chochem of his area, and one of the greatest Talmidei Chachomim of the entire Talmud, he never received smicha. And he himself commented upon it, that he saw in the book, this great book of original man, of Adam Arishon, in which everything was written down as to what would be in the future. So he saw that Shmuel would be called the Rosh Yeshiva, and he'd be called the Talmud Chacham, but he would not be called Rav. And therefore, he was called Mar Shmuel. That's the name that he has all the time. So it could very well be that the same thing occurred here with Ravashi's son, that he never received the official rabbinic ordination, and therefore he was not called Rav Avyume, but he was just called Mar Bar Ravashi, and that his title became his name, so to speak. Now, we have to backtrack and say something about Ravashi. Ravashi is one of the main editors of the Talmud. We're talking here about the end of the Talmudic period when this great work is being put into its final form. So in the previous generation, Ravina was the editor, and then Ravashi is the final editor, so to speak, of the Talmud, even though work on the Talmud continued after the death of Ravashi as well. And even after the final edition of the Talmud, there was an entire generation of scholars called Rabbonon Savuroi, the rabbis who came to explain it to us, who put final touches in the Talmud. For instance, in the tractate of Kiddushin, the first page and a half, are from the Rabbonon Savuroi, are 50 years after the completion of the Talmud. They're the ones that inserted that first page and a half in, so that still was a work in development. But by 560, 570 of the Common Era, the Talmud is in the form that we have it today. And from then on, there begins the period of the Gaonim, the great leaders of the Babylonian community mainly, though some of them already immigrated to North Africa and then to Spain and to the French Rhine, to the German Rhineland, to Mainz. And after that, we have the period of the Rishonim, Rashi and Tosfos and the Rambam and the Ramban and all the other great men. And then we have the period of the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, and the Maharshal in Lublin, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Yisraelish in Krakow. And then after that begins the period of the early Achronim, and then down to our time, the latter-day Achronim, like the Chazon Ish, and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and others, who continued the chain of tradition until our time. So that was how the setup was. Now, Rav Ashi, I mentioned before, there were four great Jewish cities in Bavel. Three of them we have discussed in the previous two lectures. We've discussed Sura, where Rav was, where Rav Huna and Rav Chisda were, and then we discussed Nahar Doe, where Shmuel was, and then we discussed Pumpedisa, where Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshes were in Ardoya, and Rabba and Rav Yosef were in Pumpedisa. Those were three major cities. They fell into decline in about the year 420 for various reasons, mostly economic reasons. The trade routes changed. The Silk Route moved a different direction, and the Jews began to lose their economic stability. When that happens, so then people move. They move to where the economic situation, I mean, if they can move, if they have any mobility, so they move to where the economic situation is better for them. So now there was a city called Machsia. That's the fourth city. In the Talmud, it's called Mosa Machsia, the city of Machsia. Now, Machsia was famous for nothing. It was a hinterland. It had no yeshiva there. It had no, the Jewish community there was not very strong. And in fact, it was largely a non-Jewish community. The other three communities that I've mentioned to you had a very large Jewish population, and because of that, they were almost Jewish cities, to the extent that there are certain cities in the world today that have a very large Jewish population. Let's say Brooklyn in New York, or New York City generally, has a very large Jewish influence, simply even though the Jews are not the majority by far. But it has a great Jewish influence because of the mass of Jews who live there. And that was true of Pumpedisa, it was true of Nardoya, it was true of Sura, but it's not true of Mosa Machsia. Mosa Machsia is a very non-Jewish town, and because of that, the likelihood of it being a Torah center was never really taken into consideration because of the fact that it, so to speak, did not have the support, it didn't have the foundation upon which such a great institution of Torah could be based. All of this changes with Rav Ashi. Now, Rav Ashi lives a very long life. He lives till 92 years old, and Rav Ashi is the great man of his generation, the sixth generation of Amoraim, and Rav Ashi moves to Mosa Machsia. And when he moves to Mosa Machsia, he attracts a large number of Torah students to come with him. He builds the institution of Torah there. He himself is an independently wealthy person. We see throughout the Talmud that wealth is not to be treated lightly. The Talmud does not preach poverty for Jews. And the Talmud is full of illustrations of wealthy people who, because of their wealth, were able to advance the cause of Torah. He's a very wealthy person, and he has this tremendous vision. And he says about himself, I have built the city of Mosa Marcia. I'm the one who built it. What does he mean, built? He didn't build it in terms of being a contractor or in terms of the finances of the city. He means I have built it into a place of Torah. I have built it into a place where it'll be on the Jewish map for all eternity. Every city that had a major yeshiva in Jewish history is remembered, even when the city is forgotten for all other reasons. And therefore you have small villages like Volozhin or Mir, which in Russia were tiny villages, 90 families, 150 families, sometimes 350 families. You know, it's one apartment building in Harnov. Legal apartment building in Harnov. You would think that we're talking about Jewish cities that contain a million people. But because of the fact that it was a place of Torah, because it was a place of yeshivas, and therefore it is baked into the memory of the Jewish people. And that's true of today as well. You have, for instance, a small town in England called Gateshead, which has absolutely no, economic or aesthetic value. No one moves there for the climate. It really is a it essentially is a very depressing place. But because of the fact that it has the major yeshiva in Europe is located in Gateshead, so therefore in the Jewish world, Gateshead, everybody knows Gateshead. It's a and that's the same thing is true. Lakewood in New Jersey is famous in the Jewish world, not because it's Lakewood, because Lakewood, believe it or not, Lakewood used to be the winter resort for New York. Because the average temperature is 5 degrees warmer Fahrenheit than New York. So that used to be the winter resort until the Jews discovered Florida and the airplanes and condominiums and the whole world changed. But Lakewood is not remembered today for anything else except for the fact that it has the great yeshiva in Lakewood and thousands of Torah people there. And so that's what put it on the map. If you go to the Diaspora Museum, they have a poster, a very interesting poster. It's called the Yam HaHalacha, the Ocean of Torah. And it has in the ocean all the names of the cities throughout the world on this great map of the world of where the great yeshivas were. And that's our map, right? There's a National Geographic has a map, and everybody has a map of the world as they see it. The famous cartoon in the New Yorker magazine, the cover of the New Yorker magazine, is how a New Yorker sees the world. So the first 80% of the foreground is New York City. Then there's the Hudson River, which occupies another 5%. Then there's New Jersey that occupies about 10%. And the rest of the world has the other 5% of space to look at. Well, so there's an outlook always in the map, how it should look. What does it represent? The Jewish map represents Torah, represents where Torah is. And therefore, even here in Israel, we have small places. Tifrach is famous because of the fact that Tifrach has yeshivas, but even though it doesn't have much else. And the same thing is true of countless other places. So wherever there's a Mokom Torah, wherever there's a place of Torah, that it justifies its being on the map. And so that's what Rav Ashi meant when he said, I built Mosa Marcia. I made Marcia a city. I made it a city that'll be remembered eternally, as it is. We know Machsia is long since gone. It's sunk into the sands. And there's no commercial traffic there anymore. But anybody that opens the Talmud will meet the people of Machsia and will hear what Rav Ashi has to say about them. Rav Ashi said, in wonderment, he said, I cannot understand why the non-Jewish population of Machsia does not convert and become Jews when they see the greatness of Torah here, especially twice a year in the Arche Kala, in the months of the Kala that, again, I discussed with you yesterday, the month of Adar and the month of Elul, when tens of thousands came to Machsia to study Torah for the month. He said, and they see such greatness in Torah and they remain unmoved. He said, I cannot understand why that should be. But we can understand why that should be, because we are also witness to it, right? I cannot understand why let's not talk about non-Jews. You cannot understand why a large percentage of Jews are not moved. I lived in a community called Muncie. It was almost a community. And I was a rabbi there. And next to us, we had little towns, Suffern, New City, Pomona, which had also Haverstraw, had heavy Jewish populations. And I would often have dealings with people in those communities. And I echoed Rav Ashi. I can't understand they're living next to a community like Muncie that has so much Torah and so much Judaism, and they are completely unaffected. Not only unaffected, disaffected by it. I remember that, I have a good friend of mine who's also a physician and who I would go to for regular checkups on one of the parts of my body. And he really was a person with a great, he is a person with a great soul. And he's semi-observant. I remember once I said to him, well, why don't you move to Muncie? And he said, I cannot afford it. So I said, well, there's cheaper housing, you know. I didn't understand what he meant. He said, no, you can't understand, I can't afford it. He said, I can't afford to live there because that will affect such a change in my lifestyle. He said, my wife won't go along with it, my children won't go along with it, I just can't do it. So I remain here on the outskirts. And perhaps that's what was in Moshe Machsi also, because sometimes too much is also repellent, also holds people back. And but Rav Ashi felt that Moshe Machsi was the great city, and he is the one that built it. Now, Rav Ashi, as I mentioned, the one of the main editors of the Talmud, if not the main editor, and he's the head of the yeshiva for over 60 years in Moshe Machsi. So he had generations of students who were his disciples. To be a Rosh Yeshiva over 60 years. In our time, we had a person like that also, Reb Shimon Shkop, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, who began his career when he was 18 years old. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in Telz. And then he had his own yeshivas in Bryansk, and finally in Grodno, in Maltz, and then in Grodno. And he was a Rosh Yeshiva for over 60 years, till he died in the Grodno ghetto in 1940. There are, for instance, Rabbi Unterman, who was the chief rabbi here in the land of Israel, the third chief rabbi, he was the one who succeeded Rabbi Herzog, was a student of his. And then, but he was from one generation, and then there were many others from different generations. So Rav Ashi also spans an entire era simply because of the fact that he has so many students. Rav Ashi dies in 426 of the Common Era. And so then the question is, who should succeed him as the head of the yeshiva? He has this son, Mar Bar Rav Ashi, Rav Yume Bar Rav Ashi. Mar Bar Rav Ashi is already well known as a scholar. He's also a very wealthy man, which seemed to be a pretty much a prerequisite in certain communities because of the fact that they had to support the yeshiva. The yeshiva rarely, if ever, appealed for funds. It was supported by the people who headed it. Very interesting concept. And so he was a wealthy man, he was a great scholar, and he's the son of Rav Ashi. So everything together should indicate that he should succeed his father as being the head of the Jewish community in Machzia. But that does not happen. Now here we enter a minefield in the Jewish world. And it's been a minefield for many, many centuries. And that is a son entitled to inherit his father's position? Is he entitled to inherit his father's position as a Rosh Yeshiva? Is he entitled to inherit his father's position as a rabbi of the community? So it's interesting. This question is discussed in the halachic works, and there are opinions both ways. One of the most interesting things is that the Chassam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, who was the Rav in Bratislava and Presburg, so he was asked the question, and he, in the first response that he wrote about it, he said that a son is not automatically entitled to his father's position, and that the elders of the community or the members of the community have the right to elect anyone that they want. He said, in effect, there's no chazakah, there's no inherent right for a son to take over his father's position. He was asked the question 30 years later, when already he had sons and he was older, and there he reversed himself. And he said that the son does have a preferential right to take over his father's position. So there's a famous story in the Schreiber family, in the Chassam Sofer's family. When the Chassam Sofer's son, the Ksav Sofer, died. So he died young. He was 55 when he died. And the tradition in the family is that when he was 5 years old, the child suffered from diphtheria, which at that time in the early 19th century was almost invariably fatal. And as the child lay on his sickbed, and the doctors could do nothing for him, so his mother, Sam Sofer's wife, said to Rav Moshe Sofer, she said, "You pray for everyone, you know, and here you're like you've accepted the fact that it's going to happen. Intercede with heaven." And the story goes that he went into his private study and he emerged a half hour later just dripping wet with sweat and tears. And he told her, he said, "I got him 50 years. And when he was 55, he passed away. So when he passed away, he had a son, the Shevet Sofer, who was then a young man who was 28, 29 years old. And the elders of Presburg felt that their community needed a great name and a much more mature person, someone that that had made a name for himself, that because Presburg now, since the Chsam Sofer had been the Rav there and the Ksav Sofer had been the Rav there, so they weren't about to take someone that was, so to speak, unproven and hadn't made his name in the world yet. They were going to look for a big candidate. Just to show you how sensitive community leaders can be towards the rabbi's family, the tryout was they invited rabbis to say the hesped at the funeral. I mean, lest you think that everything happens here in Israel or in America. Yeah, we have an old history of not getting it, just not understanding anything. The family retaliated. The family said they would not allow the Ksav Sofer's body to be buried unless his son was appointed the Rav before the funeral. 3 days passed, and the family would not budge. And the community, afraid of the consequences of that, gave in, and his son was appointed the rabbi, even though he was so young. And that became the dynasty of the Schreibers in Presburg, till the Shoah, that it was always the son. So there is this matter that the son has a preference. The son has to have some other credentials as well, not just being the son. But all things being unequal, the son will prevail. That's true even today also, especially if the matter is taken to a Din Torah. Most of the time, the Din Torah will award to the family the position, or at least enough of the position that gives the person an edge and an ability to be there. Whether that's correct or not is a different matter, but that's the practicality of the matter. Now, Mar Bar Avashi, when his father dies, so Mar Bar Avashi is already a man close to 60. He's well established, and I mentioned he's wealthy, but the rabbis do not appoint him as their father's successor. Rather, they appoint Mereimar. Now, Mereimar was a student, the first generation of students of Rav Ashi. Now, Mereimar is older than Mar Bar Avashi. And since he was from the first generation of students, so he had this great standing in the community. And therefore, Mar Bar Avashi accepts him as the head of the head of the yeshiva, the head of the community, without a murmur, without complaint. However, Mereimar does not live long. And 5 years after his appointment, he dies, and the position is open again. Second time, the rabbis again do not choose Mar Bar Avashi, but they choose Rav Idi Barovin, who is also a student of Rav Ashi. Rav Idi Barovin appears in the Talmud, but he appears very sparingly. We don't have much material from him. Now, he serves as Rosh Yeshiva 20 years, so that Mar Bar Avashi is already in his 80s. And he's the Rosh Yeshiva for 20 years. And he passes away in 511. And then the rabbis meet again. Who to pick to be his successor. And they choose the disciple of Rav Ashi, Rav Nachman, the son of Rav Huna. But they don't install him. And now, Marbar Rav Ashi realizes that if he stays in Mosa Machsia, people will feel that, you know, that he's insulted, etc. So therefore, he leaves his hometown when he's already an old man, and he moves to Mechoza. Mechoza was a city that Rava lived in, and one can imagine that at that age, it's not easy to move, but he does not want to be seen as a competitor or somehow someone that doesn't look with favor on the fact that Rav Nachman bar Rav Huna is serving as the Rosh Yeshiva in Machsia. A few years later, he passes away. 3 years. The rabbis meet again. Marbar Rav Ashi is living in Mechoza, and the meeting is in Mosa Machsia. But the rabbis invite Marbar Rav Ashi to come and give his opinion as to who should be chosen. Now, by now, he is the elder of the community. He has outlived all of the students of Rav Ashi. Whereas we could say regarding the first three instances that they were older than he was, and that therefore that gave them a priority in being chosen, that somehow influenced the decision. But now he is not only the wealthiest, and he's not only the great scholar, but he's the oldest as well. But they don't come and ask him to be the Rosh Yeshiva. They come and ask him his advice, who should become the Rosh Yeshiva. Now, they were discussing a man called Rav Acha Midifti, Rav Acha from the city of Difti, that he should be the Rosh Yeshiva. Now, Rav Acha, in effect, was a colleague and a somewhat student of Marbar Rav Ashi. And in the discussions, as rabbis are wont to do, they wander off the subject that they are gathered there for, and they begin to discuss Torah. And when they discuss Torah, Marbar Rav Ashi leads the discussion in such a way that all of a sudden, like a bolt of lightning, it hits them that there is nobody greater in Torah than Marbar Rav Ashi. And why should they therefore give the position to Rav Acha Midifti when they have Marbar Rav Ashi here? And therefore, almost 30 years after the death of his father, when he's already in his 80s, he's appointed the head, and he will serve as the head of the yeshiva for 13 years. Now, there's a question that the rabbis ask. You have to. There's always a background to this, as we saw in this wonderful film. Because you have to put it into the frame. If you don't put it in the frame, if you look at it all individually, so then it's, you know, it doesn't make, that the Talmud is a great hodgepodge. stories and questions and answers. And the others, it's not only that you can't see the forest for the trees, you can't even see the trees, like the Talmud is just, so you need a background. You have to be able to see it. And then the rabbis themselves said, Divrei Torah aniim b'mokom zev, ashirim b'mokom acher. The words of the Torah, if you look at it individually in this one place, it's aniim, it's poverty stricken. What do they come to teach us? What does the Torah tell us stories for? But it's ashirim b'mokom acher. If you look at the whole picture, if you see it in other places, well, you realize how rich it is, how great the lesson is. The rabbis asked the question, which is valid in our times. Loma ein b'nei talmidei chachomim, talmidei chachomim. The rabbis asked, how is it that we see so often that the children of great men, of great Torah scholars, are themselves nothing? They are not great Torah scholars. How did that, why does that happen? So whenever the rabbi, whenever the rabbis ask this type of a question, they're not looking for the logical answer. It's the environment, it's television, it's the secularism. They're not looking for those answers. They don't answer because of the Roman society, or because of the pressures, or because of poverty. That's not the answer. So they propose three answers, one of which is proposed by Rav Ashi himself. The first answer is that people should not say that the Torah is an inheritance, that the Torah is Yerushaloch. My Zayde was a Rav, my father's a Rav, so automatically I'm also a Rav. My father was a Talmud Chacham, automatically I'm a Talmud Chacham. The rabbi said the Torah is Sheino Yerushaloch. The Torah is not an inheritance. Everybody has to earn it over and over and over again. It's not a fortune that's given from generation to generation. Everybody has to earn it. And because of the fact that the children of great scholars think that they don't have to earn it, they think that it's sufficient just to be the son of somebody or the grandson of somebody. So therefore, they are not Talmid Chachomim. There's a famous story that a haughty young chassid once came to the Kotzker, to Reb Menachem Mendel Morgenstern, who took no captives, no prisoners. He tolerated nothing from anyone. And he said to him, I'm a Rebbe Sheinikol. I'm a grandson of a great Rebbe. So he looked him in the eye and he said, Esav was also a Rebbe Sheinikol. Esav's grandfather was Avraham Avinu. Don't tell me your grandfather is. Tell me who you are. I'm not looking at grandfathers. So the Talmud said that too. Sheino Yerushaloch. That's one answer that the Talmud said. Then the Talmud said a second answer, that they think they're better than the masses. Judaism is essentially egalitarian and democratic. That's the value. It's all within the framework of halacha. But I always tell the story that one of the times that I came to Israel in the 1970s, so I came from Meiriv and Shari Chesed in the neighborhood where Shlomo Zalman Auerbach lived. And so he used to daven in Beit Zvul 9:30. And I came late and there, so I caught that minyan, the 9:30 minyan. Come there's nine people. And the nine people, eight are rabbis, and Reb Shlomo Zalman is there, but there's nine people. You can't do anything with nine people. And Shari Chesed then had a street sweeper sanitation man, Frum Jew, who used to sweep the streets. He came in. He's the 10th one. Avshalom Zalman got up and hugged him. Oh, he said, wonderful. 10 street sweepers, you can say Borchu. 9 gonim, you can't do anything. So Judaism is built that way. And therefore they said, because the rabbis are too haughty, they look down at the people. Nei shem bizgabri malatzibur, the words of the Gemara. They raise themselves over the community. They don't think the street sweeper is worth anything. Not interested in them. So God pays them back that their children become the street sweepers. Now only the Gemara talks this way. And the Gemara had the good fortune of being edited in the 6th century, so it didn't have to be politically correct. Doesn't have to meet today's standards of holiness. Then Rav Ashi himself says a third reason. He said, not that they raise themselves over, but they insult others. The Lashon of Rav Ashi is, Mishum dekor le'inche chamorim. They call people donkeys. So therefore God pays them back. So he's obviously talking from experience, right? From a society where this occurred. So the rabbis went to the other extreme to show that they don't want to be tarred with that brush. They don't want that the Torah, you should think the Torah is a Yerusha. And therefore they refuse to make Marbar Avashi the Rosh Yeshiva. Once, twice, 3 times. Until they felt that the people themselves would recognize that if they appointed him now, it was not because of his father. If they appointed him now, it was because of him. And that's what the Gemara means. All of a sudden, they saw what a Talmud Chacham, what do you mean all of a sudden they saw what a Talmud Chacham for 60 years, he's teaching Torah. But all of a sudden, they saw that people would recognize that the appointment was made in his own right and not because of his father. And therefore, now they appointed him. And as I mentioned, he serves in the position for 13 years. And under him, the final touch-up, so to speak, of the Talmud is done. And we have many statements in the Talmud that he himself said. He was a very strong person. We find him arguing with his father in Halacha. We find that after his father's death, and when he became the head of the yeshiva, they came and told him, but your father said this, or your father did this. And he said, I don't care what he did. I'm doing what I want to do. Independent. And that, by the way, is always the bane of people who follow others, is that there's always someone comes and says, but the previous rabbi, he didn't do it like this, or he didn't say that. Or that isn't what your father did, or isn't it? Marbar Avashi, very strong person, and not given to, especially after all these experiences. So therefore, he runs it the way he runs it, in the way he wishes to run it. He doesn't run it, not influenced by what his father said. And in one way, the Meforshim say that he said that my father was the head for one generation, I am the head for a different generation. And that's an important rule that oftentimes is also overlooked. It's one thing to be a Rav in 1880 Eastern Europe. It's another thing to be a Rav in 2005 in Petah Tikva or in Chicago. It's a different time. The halacha doesn't change. The vision, the goals never change. But tactics, if the tactics don't change, then you're almost doomed to defeat. And therefore, his appointment now is accepted by all. And as I mentioned, for 13 years, he is the head of the yeshiva. It is because of this that the compliment is he Mar Bar Rav Ashi? Because Mar Bar Rav Ashi is the example of Torah on its own, of a person that, so to speak, overcomes his yichus. He overcomes his pedigree. He's able to prove that on his own he is the great Torah scholar. He is worthy of it. And therefore, then throughout Jewish history, throughout Jewish life, till today, the compliment that's given to somebody is Mar Bar Rav Ashi. And the criticism of someone is, there's Nitkin Mar Bar Rav Ashi. He's not Mar Bar Rav Ashi. He doesn't have that greatness, that quality to him. The Gemara says that from the time of the prophets, the time of prophecy ended, a prophecy was given to children and to the insane. The rabbis always held that those that are a little off really are a little on. God uses them. And therefore, the Gemara says that in the city of Mechoza, before he was appointed, an insane man ran in the street and said, Rav Tavyumi is going to be the Rosh Yeshiva in Machsia. This is before he was invited to come to the conference and before they chose him. But the insane man that ran in the streets that said Rav Tavyumi is going to be the Rosh Yeshiva in Machsia, it was a prophet. God put the words into his mouth. And Forshim say that that happened so that Mar Bar Rav Ashi could prepare himself for it. Could realize that even though he was overlooked three times, this time he would not be overlooked. And therefore, in order to prepare himself for being able to accept that office, so the insane man ran in the street, the shota ran in the street and proclaimed him. So you have to always listen to the crazies, because many times they forecast what the so-called rational, smart people are going to do. Tavyumi was his name. And therefore, that's why Mar Bar Rav Ashi lives in the Jewish world. He lives still today as one of the outstanding characters, one outstanding people in our world, because of his modesty, because of his scholarship, because of his patience, but because what he represents essentially the self-made person, as I mentioned before, who rises above the pedigree that the Torah is not an inheritance to him, and therefore he is appointed as the head of the community, and he, with him, really ends the period of the Talmud, and afterwards will be the period of the Rabbonot Savaroi, and then of the Gaonim as well.